Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a little bit of baseball card talk as we continue through the big old binder through the 1960s. We were looking at the legendary 1962 top set this past week. Well, now we're moving on to the legendary 1963 top set as we are right in the wheelhouse of, in my opinion, one of Topps' glory day eras. You can say the mid to late 50s was one. I feel the early to mid 60s was another. The 70s is up for debate because they had some really good cards and some not so good cards. But, you know, if you're going back to the early days of Topps, no doubt about it, early to mid 60s were just an outstanding time for them. And 1963 Topps is one of the main reasons why that era stands out. And we feature a standout player. Why did he stand out? Because, well, on this card at least, he was listed at 6'7", 250 pounds. Although through various points of his life, he could have been anywhere from 230 to 280 pounds. Yes, the big Hondo Frank Howard, pictured here with the Los Angeles Dodgers, although best known for his time later on in the 60s with the Washington Senators, and best known for hitting some colossal home runs. And in an era where we really praise and hold home run hitters high above our heads, it's amazing how Frank Howard all these years later doesn't quite get the respect that I think he deserves, at least that is outside of the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia area, where he is still legendary today. Howard, through his career, 382 home runs over a 16-season career. He averaged 33 homers a year. I think what hurt him, other than being with some pretty good Dodger teams in the late 50s and early 60s, where he was kind of lost in the numbers game. They had some quality players with L.A. back then, especially in the outfield where he played. But what really hurt him after being part of that numbers game was being part of some really bad Washington Senators teams and later the Texas Rangers. So we'll talk a little bit about the big Frank Howard and his big home runs and what he's up to nowadays. And we'll also talk about 63 Topps in just a little bit, along with some competition that Topps received in 1963. One of the few head-to-head competitions that Topps had in baseball cards, they very quickly smacked it down. But it was a harbinger of things to come a couple of decades later. First, we're going to talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, which is open 24/7 for your hobby commentary. Talk about the players that we discuss on the podcast. Talk about the sets or the podcast themselves or anything about the hobby. We had a very active week last week. Following our 1961 Topps set leading into 1962 Topps, a little quieter that week, but I think everyone agrees that 62 Topps was a pretty successful set, and there's really no arguing over if fans like it, if hobbyists like it, as opposed to the 61 Topps set, which I even said you either like it or you don't, and we heard from both sides of the aisle. Our frequent contributor, Peter Steinberg, mentioning the 62 Topps set not only looking like 87 Topps, which I brought up, but he says, I always think of Bowman's 1955 TV wood frame, though 62 is certainly more dramatic a design. And I didn't bring up 55 Bowman simply because I wanted to keep the Topps to Topps comparison going on. But you're absolutely right. One reason why 62 Topps stands out is because it was reminiscent for that generation of the 55 Bowman, which has been reproduced and reimagined numerous times, not just in Bowman heritage sets, but Topps has done it before. Other card companies have kind of mocked it before. And that just goes to show you two things. One, how creative the TV set design, the wood panel cabinet from the 1950s television sets. So it wasn't just a piece of pop art that was being represented in the form of a baseball card. But it also goes to show you how big television was in the 1950s, especially in 1955. If you know the history of television, you know, television was actually experimented with back in the 1920s and 30s. But World War II curbed any growth of that. Well, after World War II, then you had, I think only it was like 6,000 TV sets in the nation in 1946. But then that quickly grew by leaps and bounds. And by 1955, every household had one. Every form of media and entertainment was adjusting to it, much like television and radio and newspapers are adjusting to the internet these days and mobile viewing and listening technology. Well, everybody was adjusting to television in 1955, even baseball cards. And Bowman's Swan Song before Topps bought them out featured the wood grain television panel, which is still memorable all these years later. Sports Carter brought up this interesting conundrum. I am worried that if I listen to the Wax Ecstatic episodes about 60s cards, I'll want to start buying. Could be dangerous. To which I replied with, join the dark side. Go ahead and do it. And I would actually recommend, before you spend hundreds and thousands of dollars on cards from the 50s and 60s and even 70s, I would take the approach that I take, and that is, if you're just dabbling in cards from this era, just take them in any condition. Just to see them, hold them, look at them, experiment with them, learn what you can from them yourself. Don't be afraid. It's okay to expand your collecting horizons a little bit beyond current cards, beyond the junk wax era, which a lot of our listeners got involved with when we started this podcast, going through the Monster Box from the 80s and 90s. Expand on your 1970s and 60s and 50s collection. You don't need hundreds of these cards. Like me, if you just have 10, 12, 15 cards from each year, you're not concerned about the condition. You're not looking for the Mickey Mantle, the Willie McCovey, the Ernie Banks, the Bob Gibsons from every set. If you're just looking for any cards, there's plenty still out there, and they are still available at pretty affordable prices. Now, speaking of flashbacks, we had a Flashback Friday episode this past weekend, and it's one of, in my opinion, one of the most underrated sets from the junk wax era, because it was very much ahead of its time. In fact, it was doing things before Upper Deck was given credit for a lot of them, and I'm talking about crystal clear photography, putting color photographs in the back of cards, having unique designs, and having tamper-resistant or tamper-proof packaging. And that was Score, 88 Score, in fact. 89 Upper Deck gets a lot of the credit for changing the hobby, as it should, because it definitely did at that time. But Score was very much ahead of the curve in 1988 with some of those innovations that I was talking about. So we flashed back to our 1988 Score episode. Our random poll was Mike LaVallier, then with the Pittsburgh Pirates, but also known for his time with the St. Louis Cardinals. And we had some comments about that. Rick Taylor saying, I loved the back, so much information and a picture to boot. And I love the 88 Score backs as well. That was one thing that I really crowed about in that episode. Not only did you get the full color photo, but the information on the backs of those cards, and it wasn't just 88 Score, they continued to do this for several years. It was chock full of information, pretty much scouting reports. You know, they would have career stats, but whatever space was allowed, they would have some pretty in-depth scouting reports and some interesting quotes from coaches and managers and, you know, scouts and other players about the players pictured on the front of those cards. Michael Chapman with a very interesting comment, which he sent out Friday morning, actually right after we sent out the note that was our flashback episode. He says, my dad worked for Score when I was a kid. I had more boxes of cards than I knew what to do with. Well, you probably have more boxes of cards than you knew what to do with. And by the way, that makes me feel better knowing that I wasn't the only one that had way too much Score product on my hands for many years. Of course, I didn't have a family member directly involved with the production company. But even though you had too many cards, Michael, I'm sure you were also probably one of the most popular kids on the block because you had tons and tons of baseball cards for, I would imagine, a few years there. And of course, with Score coming in and eventually fading out a little later on during the junk wax era, when all of us, people my age, your age, were collecting left and right and the hobby really became a business. I'm sure a lot of people were showing up at your front door wondering, hey, do you have any more of those jumbo packs or rack packs, or can I get a box? I don't know how much your dad was able to sneak out of the factory, but that's actually very neat. Hopefully, Michael, and we did go back and forth on this on Twitter, hopefully you can tell us more about having your dad working for Score, because that's a very, very neat story. Lots of stories, lots of commentary, lots of opinions happening at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, please pass along the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter handle to your friends, your collector friends, those who collect now, those who don't collect now but did back in the day. A lot of great memories to talk about. We will link up to our new shows and our Flashback Friday shows throughout the weekends. And speaking of new shows and archive shows, you can get them all through various platforms. Audio Boom is our home base, if you will. But you can also listen to Wax Ecstatic on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and now Stitcher and TuneIn. And because we do have some small production fees to keep this podcast going, we do have a 24/7 tip jar. So if you want to contribute to the future success of Wax Ecstatic, and also if you would like to just say, attaboy, Matt, you're doing a good job, then go to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's just a link to a PayPal account. You can give us $2, you can give us $20, you can give us $200, whatever you can afford. We greatly appreciate it. And I don't want to hit that over your head too many times, but this was actually suggested by a few of our listeners during our listener survey a few weeks back. We opened it up. We've received some donations. Thank you very much to all who have contributed. And for those who haven't yet, if you can find it in your heart and in your wallet, for the cost of a couple of packs of cards these days, or half a case of 88 Donruss, that's right, just a few dollars, you can keep Wax Ecstatic going and going strong as we continue to go through the big old binder of right now 1963, but moving forward right up to 1980. And then we'll see where the podcast goes from there. That's going to be pretty interesting, because by then we will have covered nearly 40 years of baseball cards through this show. Now, one of the best baseball cards from the big old binder comes from 1963, the top set, and it is still a favorite to this day for collectors. And it's funny, we were talking about how 62 tops looks a lot like 87 tops and a little bit like 55 Bowman. Well, 63 tops, I've always compared it to 83 tops. And if you take a 63 tops card and lay it next to an 83 tops card, the similarities are absolutely stunning. I mean, it is essentially the 83 tops set, which is also a collector's favorite, is in many ways a carbon copy of the 63 tops set. I would say that 87 tops was inspired by 62 tops. 83 tops is almost just a revision of the 63 tops set, simply on design terms, or at least the front of the card. I think the two biggest differences are with the framing of the pictures. There's actual more framing with the 83 tops set as opposed to 63 tops. And then on the top of the, or the front of the 83 tops, you have the Topps logo. Of course, Topps in a very vicious battle with Fleer and Donruss for market share in 1983. 1963, not so much, so you don't see the Topps logo. However, there was some competition in 1963 from Fleer. If you don't know this story, it's actually a pretty fascinating story. The Fleer company decided to put out a set of baseball cards in 1963. They were going to try to take down Topps and at least provide a little bit of competition to the market. And they came out with a series of cards. There was supposed to be more than one series. However, Topps took them to court and shut down Fleer. So it's a very small series of cards, just 66 cards in the first series. But, Fleer actually had a set of cards that looked somewhat like the 63 top set. The big difference there is instead of having a photograph of the player in the lower corner of the card, be it the lower right or lower left, Fleer just had kind of a cartoon character of a player, throwing a ball if it was a pitcher or taking a swing if it was a position player. And then you had a full-color photograph taking up like 65% of the card, player's name, team name, and position on the front. And then on the back, you had the stats and a little bit of narrative as well. So it was amazing how much of a knockoff 63 Fleer was to 63 Tops. The biggest difference between those two sets was the backs of the 63 Fleer cards, which actually looked an awful lot like the backs of the 81 Donruss cards, which were of a vertical nature, had a pretty extensive narration, just had some limited stats. Didn't have the timeline feature like 81 Donruss had, but to the point, more words than statistics. Now, there was another interesting feature that 63 Fleer had to what they thought how they could beat Topps, because Topps didn't have a monopoly on the baseball card business. They had a monopoly on the confectionery business, that is, packaging baseball cards with bubble gum. And that's why if you look at wrappers from the late 50s and early 60s after Bowman went away, it was not Topps baseball cards, it was Topps bubble gum. And, you know, with, you know, photographs of baseball players, you know, they would have just in kind of like small print, you know, player photo cards and stuff like that. But the bubble gum was the main thing that was promoted and advertised. And of course, for a lot of kids, that's what they got it for anyways. They didn't want the cards, they wanted the chewing gum. Well, Fleer thought, all right, we can get around this confectionery thing by not offering a piece of gum. We're going to put in a cherry cookie. And I've seen pictures of the cherry cookie. If you are a Civil War buff, you know what hardtack is. Hardtack, if you're not a Civil War buff, hardtack was an all-purpose brick of flour that was baked, to put it nicely. And basically, it was just this giant brick of carbohydrates and protein. And hardtack was normally featured in the meals of Confederate soldiers, although Union soldiers sometimes had it as well, because some soldiers couldn't necessarily carry a whole kitchen of food with them. This was something that was ubiquitous. You could take it with you, you can gnaw on it, you can dip it in a bowl of water and turn it into some really disgusting kind of porridge, you could dip it in your coffee, or you can just let some worms eat it, which was often the case and caused an awful lot of digestive issues. Well, I'm sure these cherry-flavored cookies also caused some digestive issues, because this is wafer thin. It wasn't hardtack brick size, but it also wasn't bubblegum size. The Topps bubblegum back then was the thin slab, not the sticks that a lot of us remember from the 80s, but if you go from, I think, 82 back, the bubblegum was almost card size, but it was paper thin. Well, the cookies were not, so you can only imagine the mess that was made when this rather bland cookie was crumbling all over the cards here. But that was Fleer's in. They went, all right, we're going to beat Topps at their game. We're not going to put in a piece of confectionery goodness. No, we're going to put in this cookie. Well, Topps said, okay, not so fast. Took him to court. And not surprisingly, Fleer was given a cease and desist. And that was it for Fleer baseball cards, not just in 1963, but for the following 17 years. Now, Fleer still issued baseball collectibles, most notably stickers and cloth patches and stuff like that. But the idea of putting a piece of food, not necessarily bubblegum, but, you know, some kind of special dessert treat inside a pack of baseball cards, well, that was something that Topps had exclusivity to. Now, what's funny is the irony of this, while Topps was able to slam the door shut on the Fleer set in 1963, the bonus that Topps put into every pack, besides the bubblegum, was stickers. So that was something that they very blatantly advertised. I've seen the pictures of it on their wax boxes, you know, big old sticker-like logo on the fronts of these boxes that say now stickers in every pack. So you would get not a team logo sticker, which Fleer was famous for starting in 1982, but you saw player stickers. So it's kind of weird how everything went full circle here. All right, so 63 Tops was able to survive as the lone standing set after the litigation that put Fleer out of business. And 63 Tops on its own probably would have done just fine. A very popular set, like I mentioned, 576 cards, so a little smaller than some of the previous sets, which were at 589 officially. Not too many error cards, just a few variation cards. So in many ways, this was the quote-unquote perfect set for Tops, other than the usual production errors. Again, kids weren't buying baseball cards for baseball cards. They were buying them for the gum inside. So you had quite a few cards that were miscut. They were off-center. That is still one of the bugaboos for collectors these days, even though they like the design and they like the star power. You still have some cards that are a little bit skewed in terms of centering and also sometimes the rough cuts. Now, before we get to the design, we'll talk about two of the famous cards in the set. The biggest card, which happened to be a rookie card, is the rookie card of Pete Rose. Now, Pete Rose was one of those four-panel cards, that is, a rookie card featuring pictures of four different players, something that was very popular with Topps, not just in the early 60s, but throughout the 70s. They even brought it back in the early 90s. And the Pete Rose rookie card is also one of the most counterfeited cards. So if you're in the market for a Pete Rose rookie card, be very, very careful with what you're buying. Make sure it is legit, because some of these cards can go for $800, $900, $1,000. You want to make sure you're getting the real deal and not getting ripped off. Another big rookie card from that set, card number 553, Willie Stargell's rookie card. And again, that's another four-panel card. And the final player edition of Stan Musial's card can be found in the 63 Top set. Of course, you've got all the stars from the early 1960s, and one of the more popular cards is Mickey Mantle. That card, even in a lower grade condition, I'm talking PSA 6 or 7, will still cost you about $400, depending on where you buy it. So, you know, Mickey Mantle, even though his career was starting to trend downwards in 1963, still a hobby collector's favorite, and of course a favorite for many baseball fans around the world. Now, as for the design, as we go back to the comparisons to 83 Tops, 63 Tops featured a full color photograph, mostly posed shots, that took up about I'd say about 75% of the front of the card. Now, the fronts also had a white border, but a very small white border. It's not like even some of the cards that were created in the 80s and 90s that had a bigger intrusive white border. It was a very thin white border if the card was perfectly cut and centered. So you have the full color photograph that took up about 75% of the card, but in the lower corners, some cards have it on the right side, others have it on the left side, you have the inset photo. Now, this isn't all that different than what Topps did in 1954 using two photos. Not all that different with, you know, a little bit of a design element from 1958 and 59, where you have these very bright colors as backdrops to these photos. But Topps would take a black and white photo of the player, again, a pose shot, but a different pose than what you saw in the main color photo. They took that, cropped it out, put it on top of a color background, and then the bottom third or so of the card has a different contrasting color, and it's a you know, still a very vibrant color. You have the player's name, the team he plays for, and the position. So when you look at the Frank Howard card here, card number 123, you've got Hondo just kind of looking off to the side here. You could already see Topps was feeling that Frank Howard would probably not stick with the Dodgers too long, because he was lost in a numbers game of some great players on that Dodger team. So you have a shot like this that's kind of, you know, looking up at him. Of course, he was 6'7", so perhaps the photographer was looking up at him anyways. But you have the shot of him from kind of looking up at his chin, so that if he wasn't with the Dodgers, it would be a pretty easy airbrush job to take out the logo and still have an active card for him. But you've got the full color photo up front, using that same kind of Kodachrome treatment to the pictures that you saw in the very popular 57 top set. You have the inset picture, which is Hondo holding a bat. And then you've got the orange backdrop for this particular card, a dark green lower third. And then you've got Frank Howard, his name in white letters, team name and position in yellow letters. A very simple yet complex design here. That's, I think, almost the exact words I used to describe 83 Tops. If you're interested in the 83 Tops podcast, look for it on our archives. Our random poll was Mike Torres. So we've got some interesting stories about him, as he will forever be known as the guy who gave up the home run pitch to Bucky Dent in the 78 playoff game between the Yankees and Red Sox at Fenway Park. But a very simple and complex design here. This particular card, not 100% centered, but compared to a lot of other 63 Tops cards I've seen, this is actually one of the better center cards that I've seen. It is skewing a little bit to the left here, but it is not horribly off center or miscut like a lot of cards from 63 Tops are. Now let's flip the card over. It's a neat little transition here for Topps in 1963, because if you look back at the back of the 1962 cards, and our random poll was Tim McCarver in that podcast, you had the two stat line breakdown, where you had the previous year and then the career numbers. And then you had some personal information in the upper left and then a cartoon in the upper right. And all the backs of the 63 Topps cards, much like 62 Topps, were laid out horizontally. And that's a design element that Topps would use through 1966. And then they would go back and forth between vertical and horizontal before finally settling in on horizontal in 74, I believe. And they would go with horizontal for many, many years after that. Well, in 63, you still have that same basic layout, but instead of just the two-line statistical breakdown of the player's previous season and career, you have the complete major and minor league record for that player. And that is something that Topps would go ahead and do moving forward through the 1960s, in fact, through the 1970 season. They would go back to the two-line stats in 1971, but then in 1972, they would go back to the complete major and minor league record moving forward. And I've always liked the complete major and minor league record. And for me, especially with these older cards, it's neat to see players playing in the minor leagues and what are now major league cities. Now, that's not the case in Frank Howard, as he played his minor league ball in Green Bay, Victoria, Texas, Spokane, Washington. But you look at other cards from the 1960s in particular, and you see guys who play minor league ball in San Diego or Atlanta or Montreal, as the case may be. So it's kind of neat that cities that eventually became major league cities, Seattle, Toronto, Minneapolis, you know, if it's a card from the 1950s, it's kind of neat to see these cities listed here, because now they're major league cities. But back then, they were minor league backwater towns. But another thing that I like about the design of the 63 top set is this is one of the easiest cards to read. First of all, you have the white cardboard background, the white cardboard stock, which is something that Topps would utilize, again, through 1970. And as opposed to a lot of the sets in the late 50s, where certain series alternated between the gray background or the gray cardstock and the white cardstock, 63 sets are consistent. You've got the white cardstock. It's a lot easier to read, and typically the cards stay in better condition. Although this one, you know, this card is a little beat up. If I recall correctly, I bought this at a flea market in like 1990 or something like that. So, you know, it was already beat up to begin with. This didn't come from a random eBay lot. This came from a shoebox of cards that I found in a local flea market and probably paid 50 cents for. But anyways, the cardstock tends to hold up a little better than the gray cardstock, and it's a lot easier to read. And especially with the choice of colors here. With the white cardstock, you've got a yellow background and black text. It doesn't get any simpler than that. You could probably read this with the lights out. It's that vibrant, that clear, that crystal, that easy to read. So I've always liked the backs of the 63 Topps cards. And that's something, too, you know, when we talk about the design of these cards in the 1960s, Topps got innovative with the backs as well. And as we progress through the mid-60s, there are certain elements that didn't work out but are unique to particular sets. I'm thinking of the scratch-off trivia and the 64 Topps, which we'll talk about in our next podcast, but also other elements that you did see, smaller cartoons, interesting, weird tidbits about the player, not necessarily career-related. You know, if you look at the Frank Howard card here, you know, getting stronger year after year, Frank continues to improve at the plate. The outfielder was Rookie of the Year in 1960. You know, that's just a very basic career stat. But there were some factoids later on that may say player so-and-so likes to play the tuba in his spare time. Okay, that's kind of interesting. That's something you would see in the mid-60s as well. Some very interesting, sometimes off-the-wall little factoids about the player who was featured on the front of the card. But Topps was starting to get creative with the backs of the cards as well as the fronts of the cards, and you would see that evolution throughout the mid-1960s. Things got a little stale, in my opinion, in some of the later issues in the 1960s, but for the most part, again, especially in 1963, this was just right in the heart of the glory era of Topps baseball cards. Certainly the 1960s decade, you could argue, in the history of Topps baseball cards, although most hobbyists will harken back to the 1950s as that glory era. One other thing to point out here, and I read this somewhere and I never really thought of it before, but there is a little bit of an element of truth here, and that is, while we often compare 63 Topps to 83 Topps in design, 63 Topps does take quite a bit of its design from 53 Topps. And in order to do that, you would have to take a 53 Topps card where the team logo is a round logo. So you can't have like the Chicago White Sox and that triangle and the flying sock. You can't have, you know, the Brooklyn Dodgers, where you have the, you know, what is now still the classic Dodger script kind of, you know, rocketing off at an angle. You would have to have a round logo like the old Boston Braves or even the New York Yankees. Boston Red Sox, if the, you know, bat swinging sock was inside a circle. But anyways, you have to have a round logo. And if you take a 53 Topps card with the round logo and place it next to a 63 Topps card where the logo on the 53 Topps card and the picture on the 63 Topps card are in the same corner, then yes, you can definitely see some elements of 53 Topps that carried over into 63 Topps, notably the round inset picture, the lower third that had the player's name, team, and position. The biggest difference, of course, is what was in the top two-thirds of the card. In 63, you had a full-color photograph, whereas in 1953, you had a painting of the player. So, yes, there is certainly some pieces of 53 Topps that are represented well in 63 Topps. But again, if you're looking for a spitting image of 63 Topps, look no further than 83 Topps. They're essentially the same card. So 63 Topps with a great design, again, simple yet complex at the same time, but it all somehow works. With the star power, with the Pete Rose and the Willie Stargell rookies, the final Stan Musial card, the big star players, Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Sandy Koufax, you name it. This is still a very popular set, still relatively easy to find in terms of vintage cards. And again, if you're not all that particular of card condition or looking for star cards, this is a very easy one to find. Again, just go on eBay, type in 1963 Topps Baseball Lot. You will find collectors who have sets of anywhere from 9 to 90 cards in various stages of condition that are available for a pretty decent price. And I would highly recommend that you get them and at least hang on to them just because they're historically significant and really neat just to kind of look through during your spare time. Now, what's also neat to look through during your spare time is the career of Frank Howard, our random pull. And again, this is card number 123 of the 1963 Topps set. Big Frank Howard. That is a very, very simple way of putting it. Frank was one of six children born and raised in the state of Ohio. He did not miss many meals, but also not to knock on him. He came from various stories that I've read. He came from good stock, and it was a stocky family. And that worked out to Frank Howard's athletics hope. In fact, he was a dual sport star in Ohio, not just in high school, but at the Ohio State University, where he attended, actually fell just a few credits shy of getting his degree. I believe he was studying in physical education. Imagine that. But he was not only a star baseball player, but he was a standout basketball player. And of course, at 6'7", and again, depending on the report you read, from what I've read, when he was in college, he was up to 285. This guy was just an incredible man beast. I mean, you just put him down at the post, and he's there to grab all the rebounds and do a few chip shots. Doesn't matter how athletic the opposing team is, running into Frank Howard at the base of the backboard is just like running into a brick wall. And because he was so good at basketball, he was actually drafted by the Philadelphia Warriors, who, of course, later became the Golden State Warriors. So he had hopes of playing in the NBA as well. And even though, according to several reports, he was a better basketball player, he liked playing baseball even more. So it's not that often that you get the dual sport basketball-baseball tandem, but Frank Howard was one of them. Another one I can think of off the top of my head, Chuck Connors, who not only excelled in basketball and baseball, in fact, he was a member of the Dodgers organization. He was a darn good actor, the Rifleman, for many years. And we also did a podcast on a guy who was a basketball and baseball star, Tim Stoddard. And he was a guy that was, a very good basketball player, but excelled at baseball. He was our random pull from the 81 top set. That was episode number three, I believe, if you want to go back and listen to that. Episode three or four. But anyways, one of our first episodes. So it's not that usual, but it does occasionally happen. And I can only imagine what Frank Howard could have done in the NBA in the late 50s and early 1960s. Can you just imagine, Frank Howard and Wilt Chamberlain on the same team? Perhaps the Warriors would have been a little more successful in their nascent years in Philadelphia in their first few years in San Francisco. But that's the great big what if. What we do know, though, is he was an outstanding baseball player. Even though he had basketball options, he was still heavily scouted by several teams. And once he finished up his basketball season in his senior year at Ohio State, he told all the major league teams, "I'm ready." He had been in contact with the Dodgers the most. In fact, back when they were in Brooklyn, they were scouting him out. Well, they decided to sign him to a deal, again, after his senior year at Ohio State, in March of 1958. So he becomes an amateur free agent and very quickly makes his major league debut. In fact, he did so on September 10th, 1958. He clobbered a home run in his second major league at bat. It was at Shibe Park or Connie Mack Stadium in Philadelphia. Reports I've read say that he hammered it to left field. It hit a billboard on the upper deck facade of the left field stands at Connie Mack Stadium and apparently shook the billboard. He just nailed it so hard. So his reputation for being a cannon shot hitter was very, very well expected and well known, and he certainly made his mark quite literally and figuratively just a couple of at-bats into his major league career. Just a few games later, he knocked out teammate Duke Snider with a foul ball, actually ended Snider's 58 season. Snider was standing on third base. Hondo was a notorious pull hitter, and he yanked a shot low and hard and fast right to Snider's noggin. Now, as I mentioned, he was part of a numbers game, a very talented outfield for the Dodgers. So he was the fourth man in the three-man outfield. Couldn't really find a home in L.A., but also the Dodgers wanted him to work on his swing. They knew that once he connected, he could hit it 500 feet, but what they wanted him to do was work on making a little more contact. He struck out an awful lot early on in his career, and even Howard would admit that in the first several years of his major league career, all he was trying to do was hit the ball out of the park. He wasn't a very nuanced hitter. He was just a very powerful one. Well, even though he couldn't find a permanent home with the Dodgers, he still got quite a bit of playing time. 117 games by his third season in Major League Baseball. In 1962, the Dodgers move into Chavez Ravine, not exactly a hitter-friendly park, but he still hit .296 that season, 31 home runs, then a career high, 119 RBI. But the strikeouts were starting to pile up here, and this was something that worked against him. Even though he was able to work his way into games, if not as a starter, then as a pinch hitter in clutch situations, he wasn't necessarily happy about the playing time he was going to get. But he also realistically knew he was only going to get so much because there was so much talent in front of him. And especially with how the National League was being played at that time, and again, Chavez Ravine being more of a pitcher's park, while speed was more of the game, contact speed, small ball, if you will, not necessarily clobbering the ball all the time. You needed guys like that on your team. But the Dodgers were well known for their pitching, for Koufax and Drysdale, and for speedy guys like Maury Wills, not necessarily for power hitters like Frank Howard. Now, another interesting thing about Frank Howard, even though the spaciousness of Chavez Ravine worked against him in 1962, another thing that worked against him was his eyesight. Believe it or not, Frank Howard, for the great career that he had and the monstrous home runs that he hit, didn't have 20/20 vision. In fact, in one eye, he was 20/40, and the other was 20/60. Now, that doesn't sound like it's way off, but if you're somebody who wears corrected lenses or eyeglasses, you know even just the slightest bit off 20/20 can just affect your lifestyle, never mind trying to hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball coming at you. So somebody told Frank, well, you need to get glasses, and he put on the glasses, and he would wear them when he went up to the plate. So you see a lot of pictures of Howard from 63 onward, where he's wearing just wire-rim glasses, still wears glasses these days, but he was one of the few players who would actually wear glasses while out in the field or at the plate, but it certainly helped his game, to say the very least. So even though he was a member of the 63 World Series championship team, at the end of the 64 season, at the age of 27, he walks into Buzzy Bevesi's office and says, listen, what's my future going to be like? What's my career going to be like? I'm at my peak years here, but I can't really cash in on it, so to speak. He didn't demand a trade, but basically said, how am I going to get some playing time? Well, the answer came in a trade, as he was traded from the Dodgers to the Washington Senators. He, along with Ken McMullen, Phil Ortega, and Pete Riker, go to Washington for John Kennedy, Claude Osteen, and $100,000. That's right, the Senators were giving money to the Dodgers. How backwards is that? Now, to complete the deal, the old player to be named later, Dick Nen, went back to Washington about a couple weeks after the deal was made. And when you look at where the Dodgers were in 1964 and where the Senators, now remember, this is the second Washington Senators team, so an expansion team, going into their fifth season, you may go, well, this was just an absolute career-killing move for Frank Howard. Well, not so fast, because Howard got the playing time, he got the at-bats that he wanted, and he was able to finally flourish into a hitter. In fact, you look at his last season in L.A., 134 games, 433 at-bats. Well, in 1965 in Washington, 149 games, 516 at-bats. And then the legend that was Frank Howard started to emerge. Yes, he was a member of the Dodgers. Yes, he was a Rookie of the Year in 1960. Yes, he was even an MVP candidate in that 1962 season. But he really started making a name for himself in Washington in the mid to late 60s. In fact, he was starting to hit the ball well thanks to good old Gil Hodges, his former teammate who was managing the club back then. In 1967, he clobbers 36 home runs out of RFK Stadium, but he is also providing a little bit of a cool breeze for fans in various stadiums, as he led the league with 155 strikeouts. He only had 60 walks. This was a concern for the Senators because they liked his power, but they wanted him to be a little more selective. So Eventually, Gil Hodges goes off to manage the Mets. We know how that worked out. Jim Lemon comes in 1968. Jim Lemon was, by all accounts, a terrible manager, but he was a good coach, and he was able to help Hondo make a little more contact when he was up at bat. So he hits 44 home runs in 1968, 106 RBI. Batting average goes up nearly 20 points. Strikeouts start cutting down a little bit, but it's still 141 for the season. Well, the magic touch comes in 1969 when Lemon is relieved of his duties. Bob Short comes in, buys the Senators. He wants to make a big splash. Well, what bigger splash can you make than by hiring the splendid splinter, Ted Williams, to be your manager? So Teddy Baseball comes in 1969, a very famous talk with Frank Howard. He says, how can you hit 40-plus home runs and have only 50 walks? You know, you're striking out everywhere. Son, you got to take a pitch. And this was, even though Frank Howard had been in the major leagues for 10 years, this was revolutionary. This was something, wait, what you mean I'm not supposed to just swing at every ball that comes my way? And with that advice, Frank Howard has arguably his best season in 1969. 161 games, 48 home runs. That was a career best. Didn't lead the league, but it was a career best for him. 111 RBI, but here's the killer. 96 strikeouts to 102 walks. Let's back it up 2 years. 1967, 155 strikeouts to 60 walks. Led the league in strikeouts in 1967. Led the league in walks in 1970 with 132. And not surprisingly, his total bases go up. His on-base percentage goes way up. His batting average goes up. He's now hitting around 300. And he's an all-star, first-time all-star in 1968, second-time in 1969. The Senators hosted the all-star game at RFK Stadium in 1969, finished fourth in the American League MVP voting that season. And like I said, 1970 was equally a good year with 132 walks. Still struck out a lot, 125 times, but he had 44 home runs, 126 RBI, led the league in both categories that year, and again was an MVP candidate and an all-star. Unfortunately for Frank Howard and for Ted Williams and for Bob Short, there wasn't a whole lot else besides Frank Howard going right for the Washington Senators. They had a lot of prospects. They were building up to a pretty good team in the mid-60s under Gil Hodges, but Again, Jim Lemon wasn't a very good coach. Ted Williams was still, you know, this was his first managerial job, so he was learning the ropes here. And Ted Williams, and I remember reading this in a great biography about him called The Kid. He was just beside himself. He just couldn't understand how these young baseball players just couldn't hit a baseball. And it was a completely different generation of baseball players in the late 60s compared to when Ted Williams started playing in the late 30s and early 40s. So Ted Williams just couldn't figure it out. Bob Short was losing money, and he eventually moves the Senators to Dallas-Fort Worth. They become the Texas Rangers, and let the history records show that Frank Howard was the last player to homer for the Washington Senators. Unfortunately, it came in a game that the Senators had to forfeit, because by then it was well known that the Senators were leaving for Texas. Fans were rioting and pulling apart chairs and scoreboards and you name it at RFK, and they had to forfeit the game to the Yankees. In his first year in Texas, the career is winding down a little bit. Despite the dry, warm air and the jet-like wind pattern that would carry balls out in the old Arlington Stadium before they put advertising behind the outfield bleachers, you had a real jet stream effect out there. Anyways, 95 games in 1972 with the Rangers, hitting only .244, only 9 home runs, 31 RBIs. He was not really fitting in with Texas, so the Detroit Tigers purchase his contract. He finishes up the 72 season with Detroit and plays in 1973 with the Tigers as a designated hitter. Of course, first year as a DH in the American League. 85 games, 12 home runs, a .256 batting average. Gets released by the Tigers in 1973. In fact, wasn't on their postseason roster, even though they won the American League East, eventually losing to Oakland in the ALCS. So he goes to Japan, and Japan was starting to become a whole new place for baseball players to extend careers in the 1970s. Big Frank Howard had one at-bat, took a mighty swing, twisted his back, and never played baseball again. So his professional baseball career ended, like I said, 16 seasons, 382 home runs, 1,119 RBI. And he was known for some legendary home runs. In fact, there was a story about how he hit a ball foul that a lot of players thought was fair in the old Yankee Stadium. Not only did he hit it out of the playing field, but he hit it out of the stadium. One of just a handful of players to actually do that. He is also one of four players, along with Cecil Fielder, Mark McGwire, and Harmon Killebrew, to hit a ball out of Tiger Stadium over the left field roof. And he also reportedly hit a ball out of Forbes Field at Pittsburgh that traveled an estimated 560 feet. But again, if you look at pictures of Frank Howard then and even now, the man was all muscle. I mean, we talk about 6 foot seven, 230, 250, 285 pounds. This man was pure beef. Didn't actually take care of himself that much. In fact, reading a Sabre story about him, and this was written by, let me get the author here, Mark Armour, who wrote for the Society for American Baseball Research. A lot of his teammates in Washington were amazed at how he would come into training camp at 300 pounds, but he would work it off. He would exercise. He would wear the rubber suits out in the field. He would sit in the sauna. So he would sweat off these pounds. But then as soon as the workout was done, it was like, hey boys, let's go out to eat. And then they go to, you know, a McDonald's and grab some hamburgers, or they go to a bar and have a few beers. So it's just like, well, it's not exactly the best training regimen. Of course, Frank Howard was not the only baseball player to do that back then. But even though he was not known for maintaining his physique, he was still a very powerful beast because of his size. His nickname over the years would change from Hondo, which is the name of a John Wayne movie, by the way. It went from Hondo to the Washington Monument, and also my favorite, the Capital Punisher. And there are a lot of pitchers in the American League who would agree with that assessment. There was a lot of people that they would rather face than Frank Howard, despite how poor the Washington Senators were for many years. Now, after his playing days, and like I said, they ended with injury, well, he very quickly got into coaching and managing. He managed the Spokane team. I believe they were still the Spokane Indians back then, or the Spokane Chiefs the mid-1970s, 1976, I think. Got into coaching with the Milwaukee Brewers, was actually the manager of the San Diego Padres in 1981, replacing broadcaster turned manager turned back to broadcaster Jerry Coleman from the season before. Eventually, Dick Williams would come in and replace Frank Howard. But even though he wasn't very successful as a manager, he'd go back into coaching, went as a coach as the Mets, was an interim manager in 1983. Again, was too nice of a guy to be a manager, so he kind of found his niche in coaching. Would coach with the Seattle Mariners, would coach with the New York Yankees, and also would coach for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. In fact, that was his last major league coaching job. I remember it. I think he was a bench coach in, I want to say, 99 and 2000. It was either 98 to 2000 or 99 to 2000, but that's what he was doing. As I mentioned before, he is still much loved in the Washington, D.C. area. In 2008, when the Nationals moved into their new stadium, they had to turn back the clock day, so they invited back a lot of the Washington Senators, and the most thunderous applause went to Frank Howard, who jokingly said that he'd be amazed if he could run out to left field without having a coronary. And there are three statues at Nationals Park in Washington, D.C., out in a courtyard beyond center field. One is Walter Johnson, who, of course, was the incredible pitcher who was there for the first Washington Senators team, the world champion Washington Senators teams back in the 1920s. Josh Gibson, who was part of the Homestead Grays. They were with the Negro Leagues. They played in Old Griffith Stadium. And then, of course, Frank Howard is the third statue. So if you ever go to Nationals Park, look for that. See if it's life-size, too, because I can only imagine the price tag on the 6'7", 285-pound statue that was put out there several years ago. He is known for a very kind heart, is very active in raising funds for the St. Jude's Society, which is awesome. And he's really just an awesome person and doing very well from last check. Is living in the Northern Virginia area now, of course, where he saw much of his fame in his career. So a very big heart, a very big set of biceps, and a very big bat from Frank Howard from a very big and popular 63 top set. He is our random pull card number 123. So there's our look back at 63 tops, a memorable set, a very memorable player in Frank Howard. And curious what you think about 63 tops. Let us know at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. If you want to talk about that set, our podcast of it, or the career of Frank Howard, go ahead and do so. And don't forget, we've got a Flashback Friday edition of Wax Ecstatic coming up this upcoming weekend. And then next week, we will go back to 1964. Take a look back at a set that at first I wasn't all in love with, but over time I grew to really like it. And considering it's part of, again, that glorious stage of Topps cards from 1962 to 1965, it actually fits in rather nicely and actually represents the time really well. While 63 Topps was simple yet complex, 64 Topps was very simple, sharp, businesslike, and still looks very, very good more than 50 years later. So that's coming up on our next podcast. That is next Tuesday, the new podcast following our Flashback Friday edition this weekend. You can catch new podcast and archive podcast as well at Audio Boom, iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, or Stitcher. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on Wax Ecstatic, please give us a buck or two, please, at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you, as always, for tuning into Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time.